under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Delighted to have Chris Butler back with us on Church and Culture today. Chris has been on several times before. He's executive director at Americans for Tax Reform in Washington, D.C. He's managed the group there since 2008. Americans for Tax Reform, one of the most powerful organizations in the country. They argue for tax reform, and they're very famous for their founder, Grover Norquist's pledge that he asked people running for Congress and the Senate and so forth to take, and that is no more taxes. Chris is a Catholic. He's a convert from Lutheranism, and one of the times he was on, we talked about liturgy because that's one of his great passions, the great Catholic liturgy. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dale. Thanks for having me. It's an exciting time.
Yeah, we want to talk about the new tax bill that is going to committee. Let's first describe to our listeners, now that this bill has passed both the Senate and the Congress, what happens? It goes to committee. Does it have to be voted on again, or is that just a formality?
Yeah, so it's passed both the House and the Senate in different versions. The House has already voted to appoint conferees and go to conference. The Senate is expected today to vote to disagree, to formally disagree with the House and go to conference. Currently, the Senate is negotiating with itself on who the conferees will be. And then once both the conferees are named, it will probably take a week, maybe a week and a half, and then a compromise bill will be back as a privileged on the privileged calendar in both the House and the Senate and we expect that to be about a week and a half, so probably the very end of next week, but probably the week after.
Well, you know, we've heard the predictable reactions. Since it's a Republican bill, we've heard from Democrats that it hurts the poor. We've heard from the Republicans that it's going to lower taxes on the middle class, and it's going to lower corporate taxes. We're going to do details on all this as we go along, mm-hmm. and that it's going to strengthen the economy. Knowing you and knowing your organization, I assume you agree with the Republican point of view on this. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a perfect bill. Mm-hmm. It's not what we would have designed. But in the current environment with the bare majority that Republicans have in the Senate, and more importantly, the cumbersome rules that prohibit the Senate from operating in a simple majority rules way when it comes to most legislation, they've really gotten to a great place in terms of creating a package that's pro-growth and that cuts taxes on taxpayers of every income level. It's been a little bit disappointing to see the misleading statements that have been made about the plan and its effect on the lower income levels. by many folks in the media. And it's also been disappointing a little bit in the public relations effort and the ability to get the message out about it being a giant tax cut. The fact is it's a $1.5 trillion tax cut, and it's not a zero-sum game, and the individual side and the corporate side are totally isolated from each other. So despite what a lot of Democrats are saying, a lot of the folks on the left, there's no corporate tax cuts are being paid by increases on anyone. And in fact, even within the individual income quintiles, the distributional effects of the tax code are not being shifted here. And that's another important.
Before you get any further into the weeds, Chris, because I know you live and breathe this stuff, whereas our listeners don't, not do I for that matter, I'm more interested in organizing my Christmas music collection right now. Which I'm sure you would enjoy talking about, too, by the way. We've heard from some bishops that this bill hurts the poor. And I've studied this in detail, and I don't get it. I can't find any aspect of this bill that takes any money away from lower income levels at all. In fact, with the standard deduction being being doubled from $6,000 to $12,000, it means that everybody benefits from that. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's right. Taxpayers at every income level are going to benefit from this. The criticisms of the bill, that it supposedly hurts poor people, are based on one of two things when you dig into them, the arguments that everyone has made. One is that part of these tax cuts, now we're talking about tax cuts here, right? So part of the tax cuts that we're passing will expire in 2027. So there will be, because the cut that we're now passing will expire in 2027, that means that some people will see their taxes go up from 2026 to 2027. So this is being disingenuously referred to as a tax increase in year 2027, and people are being told that their taxes are going to go up in 2027.
By the way, that doesn't mean they're going to go up. It just means there'll be another bill, correct?
Yes, absolutely. It means there'll be another bill. The only reason for that, that's entirely based on procedural reasons, which, by the way, is a result of Democrat intransigence on this issue. But it's only for procedural reasons that these have to expire, and they will be renewed, as they have been in the case in the past. But it's either
Number one, that's completely disingenuous, because that's looking down the road 10 years, and nobody can say for sure what the next tax bill will be to go forward from there.
Right, absolutely. It is the stated intention of everyone to renew these tax cuts between now and 27. They're intended to be permanent.
And what's the second reason?
So the second reason is a very convoluted thing. So because we are repealing in the Senate bill, and hopefully it will be in the overall package, the individual mandate, that is that piece of Obamacare that requires people to buy an Obamacare-approved health insurance plan. Because they're repealing that and not making people buy that, the Joint Committee on Taxation that scores these things is saying that for that reason, some people will not, at low income, will not get subsidies because they're not being forced to take them.
Huh.
Therefore, they will not be receiving as much in the way of aid, and therefore it will have a negative distributional effect on them economically, which is really tangential.
I've heard that so many millions of people are going to lose their health care.
Yeah, that's based on the same thing. That's based on the fact that we are no longer going to force some people to buy health care. Therefore, they will, quote, lose it, unquote. When in reality, if you tell someone you no longer have to do this and they choose not to do it, it's pretty disingenuous to say that you're taking away their health care.
So those are the main two reasons. I'm still baffled how anybody in good faith can say that this bill hurts the poor. Look, can I try out my reason why I think they're saying that?
Yeah, sure.
There was a famous French anarchist philosopher, Proudhon, who said that property is theft. And therefore, if you have the attitude that wealth, any form of property, really belongs to the state, and, you know, that's, of course, the argument against withholding taxes, not to the individual. If it belongs to the state and the state only sort of allows us to keep it, then you could argue that any tax cuts, which then take money away from the government, then deprive the government of income it can use to help the poor through entitlement programs. Do you think any of that is behind this?
Yeah, I mean, if you say that cutting taxes or decreasing the amount of tax that you take from people is giving them money, you're operating under the assumption that all the money by default belongs to the government. And so if the government condescends to allow you to keep some of that money, it's giving you that money. And we fundamentally reject that. I mean, that money belongs to the people that earned it. It's the fruit of their labor. And it should only be taken, away with for very serious reasons. You're absolutely right on that being a primary motivation, I think.
Well, that seems to be a mindset that I think is behind a lot of their criticism. But let's get into the details a little bit.
Okay.
Let me start with this question. At what level of income do American citizens begin to pay taxes?
Well, under the new bill, it differs a little bit, only slightly, between the House and Senate version, but the standard deduction will go up to about $12,000 per individual and $24,000 per couple. So before that, they're not going to be paying any taxes at all. Even once they get there, they're still going to be refundable credits that are available to them, even if they're under that amount. So they'll actually be a significant group of net negative taxpayers. We would consider that money spending, and maybe it's a good idea, and maybe it's not to spend that money in that way. But
I mean, is that money that people get from the government because they go negative?
Yeah, that's right.
They actually get money back?
Yeah, that's right. So
did that start, Chris?
So the Earned Income Tax Credit is the biggest piece of that. That started during the Clinton administration. And then the Child Tax Credit has been partially refundable for a while now, and I don't remember when that was changed in that regard. But this a portion of the expansion, I guess we'll probably talk about the child tax credit, but the a portion of the child tax credit is refundable as well, the expansion of it.
What is the child tax credit going to be?
Well, again, it differs a little bit between the House and the Senate bill. The versions that passed, as amended, passed the House and the Senate. On the House side, it's $16,000. On the Senate side, $2,000 per child.
Big difference.
Yeah, it is.
What will it end up being?
I think it'll wind up being $2,000 because of the pressure that's being exerted by some of the folks in the Senate to have that as high as possible. In particular, Rubio and Mike Lee have been pushing pretty hard, and Ivanka Trump has also been working pretty hard to try to move up the child tax credit.
Wait a minute, you said it was going to end up being $2,000, not $16,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant 1600.
Okay.
The House version was 1600, not 1600.
What is it now?
1000.
Okay. So when all is said and done, if I wanted to make a statement to say Americans who make X amount of money don't pay any taxes, I know that would depend on whether you're a couple, whether you have children. But let's take a couple with two kids. How much income, up to what level of income would they most likely pay no taxes at all?
There's a little bit of difference between the two plans, and it depends. But if it's a couple, it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 with two children. Different situation.
Roughly speaking, we can say if you make $30,000 or less, you're not going to pay taxes at all. In fact, you may get money back
right
from the government because of the earned income tax credit. Now,
Now
going up from there, how many tax brackets are there likely to be?
Well, they've got there are four brackets on the House side, and then the Senate side retains the current seven brackets. And then the first bracket in the House side is a 12%, and it kicks in. It'll just be marginally applied to that that income that's above that amount, whatever it winds up being, you know, somewhere between $24,000 and $30,000 for a family of two. So that 12% would be applied to whatever is between that sum and $90,000 on the House side.
Up to $90,000.
Yeah, and then that's where the 25% bracket would
By the way, let's pause for a second. 12%. Let's call it from $30,000 to $90,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of people in our nation. Probably, I'd guess, most people in our nation. And at least most people who have full-time jobs. And what is that number presently for that income group?
So the current brackets kick in earlier, and they tick up more rapidly. So I don't know it's not an easy figure for me to come up with that what that number would be, but it would be somewhere. It would start earlier than $24,000. First of all.
So in other words, these people are getting a break.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely,
okay.
They are.
So even if even if you prescind from the issue of poverty level, and you go to, I guess we could call it middle class or lower middle class. I hate those labels, but I mean, my first year as a full time college professor, I made $10,000. You know, and by my ninth year, I was making $28,000. And that was the beginning of my adult life from the age of 30 to 40, okay? So I was definitely in this group, but this would have been in the 80s. They are definitely benefiting from this bill, as are those who are underneath 30,000. But as you say earlier, it's being called an assault on the poor because of the mandate issue. And I want to come back to that and explain that in more detail for our listeners because, you know, what did Nancy Pelosi say? This was the worst or most disastrous bill in the history of American politics or something?
Yeah, she called it Armageddon.
Where does she get that? Seriously.
Yeah, it's just hyperbolic. I mean, it's not even exciting enough to be, even if you hated it, for it to be that big of a disaster. I mean, it's a great, solid bill that people should be excited about, actually.
Armageddon. Everybody benefits. Okay, so what's the next tax bracket, roughly? I mean, I know we've got four in the House bill and seven in the Senate bill.
Yeah.
How many do you think we'll end up with? How many brackets?
I think we're probably more likely to see a final bill that looks more like the Senate bill.
The seven.
Now,
let's go to the other side. Let's go to let's flip up to the top side of the highest bracket.
Okay.
I think the argument there is over 0.5% reduction. 39 or 38 and a half, something like that?
Yeah, well, 39.6 on the House side and 38.5. It goes down from a point to 38.5.
So the argument there is over the wealthy. And where does that bracket start, the highest bracket?
$1 million on both in both plans.
Okay. So millionaires, roughly.
Yeah.
The argument there is whether they're going to pay 39.5 or 38.5, roughly, right?
Yeah, roughly.
And that is that's the same as it is right now. And that's if that doesn't change, it may go down one percentage point.
Right. Right.
So where are we getting? I mean, is this where we have to talk about corporate tax cuts? Because is the argument that this is a tax reform bill that benefits only the rich, is that really more targeting the corporate side than the individual side?
Well, I think that's part of the argument. But there people also make the argument that if you cut everyone's taxes, but some people's taxes are cut by more because they pay more in taxes, then that is benefiting, in their mind, that is, again, benefiting the rich at the expense of others. So that is a piece of it, too, that simply the fact that you know, it's if someone is paying, $10,000 in taxes, but in the future they only pay $8,000, and someone else who makes much less money is only paying $1,000, but in the future they pay only $500, then some folks on the left will make the argument that you're giving away money to the rich from the poor, which is, again, is pretty, I think it's disingenuous, but they do talk an awful lot about the corporate tax rate.
I just really didn't understand anything you just said, because I can't get myself inside the mindset that looks upon tax reduction in that way. Could you try explaining that one more time?
Yeah, sure. So the concept is that if you cut everyone's taxes by a certain percentage, but because today people that make more money pay disproportionately more taxes.
Right.
So if you cut everyone's taxes, then the people in the top income brackets are going to have a larger tax cut in terms of dollar amount, not in terms of percentage.
So in other words, the 1% reduction for the millionaire ends up to be more cash than the, say, 10% cut for somebody at a lower level.
Right, right.
And that is unfair.
Yeah, that is unfair. That's considered to be unfair by some people.
So we shouldn't be looking at this from percentages. We should be looking at this from dollars saved, according to them.
Yeah, that's right. And they will say we don't give as much money to the lower incomes as we do to the upper incomes, which would mandate just writing checks to people. Because they simply don't pay enough in taxes.
Then we got to get away from marginal tax rates that base themselves on percentages. Okay. Well, let's get past that. Let's go to the corporate side.
Okay.
The present corporate tax rate in the United States is one of the highest in the world. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It is just about 40% when you include our state and local corporate income tax burden. The OECD average is 20. That is the Organization of Economic Cooperation, and it's mostly the industrialized countries, the wealthy industrialized countries. The average is 23.7%, and it has gone down every year since 2008. And our rate at 40% means that we have a lot of jobs, we have a lot of corporate headquarters, and we have a lot of money that has fled out of our economy in the United States. So one really critical part of this plan is lowering that corporate rate to 20% just so that we can compete again with all of our trading partners. We also have a kind of a complicated problem in that we have something that's called a worldwide taxation system in the United States. And again, we're one of only three industrialized countries that have a worldwide taxation system. And a worldwide taxation system means that you attempt to assess American taxes on all profits anywhere around the world. And that's a real problem for American companies if they're doing business in, say, France, because first they have to pay the French corporate income tax, and then they have to pay the American corporate income tax on top of that, which is almost twice the French corporate income tax, for example, which means that what happens is they create foreign subsidiaries, and then they never bring that money back to the United States. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's kind of a simple way to explain it. So we have all this money that's trapped overseas that instead of being invested back into the United States and American companies on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have American companies losing businesses or becoming foreign companies, a process that's called inversion, which has really decimated the American corporate sector and caused real problems for our economy.
How many countries participate in this worldwide taxation system?
I believe it's just three. So, I mean, there are three that are industrialized modern economies. And one of them is Ireland that has a 12.5% corporate income tax rate, so it doesn't really matter. I can tell you, let's see, I mentioned Ireland. There's three. I was right, outside of the United States. It's Ireland, Chile, which has a 25% corporate rate, and South Korea, which has a 22% corporate rate. So the U.S. At just about 40% has, far and away a dramatically higher corporate rate than any of those countries, and we attempt to assess our taxes on everyone, on all profits earned anywhere in the world.
So will it end up being 20% or 22%?
I think that's. I hope it'll be 20%. I think it'll be 20%. You know, it's interesting because because we're so close to where other countries are, there's a much bigger difference between, say, 20% and 22% than there is 26% and 28%. And that's because business decisions are made on the margins.
Yeah.
So when you because we're right in that sweet spot right now, that's why people are so fixated on trying to stay at that 20%. Because right now, being so close to the average, at the world average at 23.7, the average of our peers around the world at 23.7%. If we even go up 1%, that can push us out of the competition with a lot of similarly situated economies around the world.
That's very helpful. I've been trying to grasp why this debate is coming up so much in what I'm reading. Thank you for that, Chris. I'm talking with Chris Butler, who is the chief of staff at Americans for Tax Reform, a convert to Catholicism, his wife Mara and six kids. Do y'all live in D.C. or in Virginia?
We live in Virginia now. We had a little row house on Capitol Hill, and my wife Mara told me that she was pregnant with our fifth that we had to move to a bigger place. So.
Yeah, I mean, those row houses are tiny. I've been in those. So how much of this criticism about it helping the poor or hurting the poor is based upon this? And, again, it would just seem to the common sense of it is, the lower the tax, corporate tax rate, the more business corporations can do, the more profits they can make, the more product they can make, the more people they can employ, the more money comes into the United States rather than going out of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that's what seems to make sense to me. I mean, and it's furthermore, it's what the data show. I mean, even there's plenty of social, of very aggressive social democracy type countries around the world that have very robust socialized service provision for a big portion of the population that have a low corporate tax rate because they've recognized this.
Yeah, let's take a quick break. I'm talking to Chris Butler from Americans for Tax Reform about the new tax bill that we're probably going to see pass before the end of the year. Take a quick break. We'll be right back.
The giving season is upon us. Give the gift of evangelization this year by purchasing the Michigan Catholic for a friend, loved one, or someone you want to evangelize. This is a present they will appreciate and that will also help them grow in their faith. Visit themichigancatholic.org or call 313-224-8002. That's 313-224-8002 to purchase your subscription today. The Michigan Catholic, your guide for living your faith. On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Our topics during Cresta in the Afternoon toggle between church teaching and then using that teaching to shine a light on our world. We'll look at Christ and culture, church and world, religion and public life, from abortion to Zechariah and everything in between. Biblical criticism, Hollywood productions, academic debate, family and love, prayer and spirituality.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Being a new mom is hard work, but you don't have to choose between caring for your baby and caring for yourself. Remember, a peaceful mom is a better mom. Make sure to sleep when baby sleeps and be confident expecting your husband's help with both baby care and the household. No, he can't do everything either, but by being honest, you can work together to make a plan that helps you achieve better balance. Just remember, always prioritize your and your baby's well-being before housework and chores. In time, I promise you'll get on top of things, but only if you can focus on keeping your wits about you until you do. For tons of tips on balancing baby and self-care, check out Then Comes Baby, the Catholic Guide to Surviving and Thriving in the First 3 Years of Parenthood. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Chris Butler, who is the executive director of Americans for Tax Reform. We're talking about the tax bill that's going into conference this week and likely will be passed in some form or another before the end of the year. Chris, why did Democrats oppose this so vigorously? Everybody gets a tax cut. Everybody ends up with more money in their pocket. Corporations will thrive, be more jobs, more profit. There'll be much better playing field of competition for the United States and other countries around the world. Why is this being opposed so viciously by the Democrats?
Well, there's a couple of different reasons. One is the corporate rate that you mentioned. The Democrats have long recognized that the corporate rate was much too high and that we are hemorrhaging business over to overseas competitors. And even President Barack Obama had recognized this and suggested a corporate rate somewhere below 28%. But their plan was always to use the bait of the corporate rate in order to increase taxes overall. So their plan was to use. So as I mentioned, this tax bill that we're talking about today is a $1.5 trillion tax cut. The Democrat plan was to increase taxes by $2 trillion and do it in such a way that the corporate tax went down. So paradoxically, when the Democrats talk about tax increases on the middle class or the poor, the plan on the left was always to increase taxes on the individual side in order to pay for corporate income tax cuts. And raise overall and eliminate credits and deductions particularly in areas like property and intangible properties for companies, in order to generate more revenue at the same time as lowering the top rate. So that's kind of complicated, but it's at the end of the day, what they wanted was overall more money, but they were willing to cut the corporate rate on paper in order to get that more money. So that's one. If we go forward with this plan, that corporate rate is not going to be available for that. Two is,
okay, so that brings up the issue of deficit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're going to do a legit across a 1.5 million trillion tax cut,
mm-hmm.
Doesn't that threaten to really create a much larger deficit?
Well, it's a point of some contention. It seems clear that a significant percentage of that $1.5 trillion will come back to the Treasury in the form of taxes that go up due to increased economic growth. Some conservative scores generally put it around at least $500 billion of that $1.5 trillion. But it's likely going to be much more than that. Long term, what needs to happen is entitlement reform in a way that puts us on a sustainable path by moving to a system that's not a pay-as-you-go system, but is a savings-based system. That's not a pay-as-you-go system, but it's a savings-based system. So that when it comes to entitlements, we don't have current workers paying for current retirees, but we move to a system where we have current workers paying for future retirees, that is themselves. And that's what we need to do to reform spending. Fundamentally, the problem with the deficit is a spending problem, not a taxation problem. So we need to address those spending problems, and we can do that in such a way that it doesn't hurt people, but actually helps people. Because we've really misallocated a lot of resources, and we're wasting a lot of those resources. But in terms of the overall threat that looms on the horizon from the unfunded liabilities of our Social Security and Medicare, the effects of this kind of a tax cut on the overall deficit, especially when you include economic growth, is really pretty minuscule. In fact, you need a growing economy in order to provide for those future needs.
You need a growing economy plus a spending program to cut out the waste.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I mean, my point of view, the waste, the kind of money the U.S. government spends our dollars on, totally unjustified. You know, why should all these, for example, universities get all these huge grants to pay for studies of lesbians and homosexuals and, self-image issues? And I mean, where is the line between what really benefits the nation as a whole and what merely promotes a certain ideological program? I mean, I know that's a tangent, but that's just one type of waste that I think needs to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also a huge amount that's consumed in the bureaucracy when we try to get resources to people that need them. On average, federal workers make roughly twice what private sector workers make. State workers make about 1.5 times what a private sector works, and these are equivalent workers. It costs the government $1 million to hire, in total, to hire a new worker.
How much?
$1 million. It's about $1.1 million, actually.
To hire what?
To hire one federal worker. Costs the federal government $1 million.
Why?
They immediately incur retirement costs for those federal workers. They acquire legal costs for those federal workers. There are legal costs that precede the acquisition of that federal worker. And then there's the pay and the average tenure that the federal worker will be on the federal payroll.
No wonder my father wanted me to go to work for the government.
Yeah, it's
He spent much of his career in the Federal Aviation Agency. And he told me, son, you need to go in the government. You'll get a great pension. You'll be able to retire early, and you'll get job security. Boy, was he right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely true. And if you're looking for the best way to spend dollars in your economy, it's not by laundering it through the federal government. I mean, even the worst state governments are still much more efficient at getting money to where it belongs.
It's the old principle of subsidiarity, right?
Yeah, that's right. People are more accountable to people that they know and people that are closer to them. It's just better spent.
Where do you think this... Well, let me ask you this. How pervasive do you think it is, and have you done any polling,
mm-hmm.
on the attitude toward wealth? It always disturbs me when I see this, you know, the left and a lot of others who are, most of the people speaking are very wealthy, who articulate this kind of knee-jerk hostility toward the wealthy. Where does this come from, and is it at all justified?
I haven't seen any polling on the attitudes toward wealth recently. I think that attitudes have changed quite a lot in the last couple of years. We did do some polling on the estate tax one time. That was actually pretty encouraging. The estate tax is paid when people die. It's paid by their heirs.
Now that's going to go down, correct?
Yeah, we don't know how much. Both the House and the Senate bills increased the exemption for the estate tax.
How much?
It's doubled to $10 million, roughly. I mean, it's between
from 5 to 10 million
more. Yeah.
Can I ask a philosophical question?
Mm-hmm.
How, in the first place, was it ever justified that a person who has paid taxes on their income their entire lifetime should have to pay taxes on it again in order to hand it off to whoever's in their will, their descendants?
It's a good question. I can't really advocate on behalf of it. It's not easy for me to play devil's advocate on that one. But it's even worse than that, because what you're doing is you're saying to someone who, you know, if you imagine someone that's, you know, say 75 and has done very well for themselves and has a lot of money, if they spend all that money, if they waste all that money and decide to go all around the world and, you know, just spend it all and burn it all down, you're giving them a tax advantage over the prudent person who saves it and passes it on to their family.
Right.
So it's that to me is the part that's really immoral about it, is creating a moral incentive for people to do something other than save their money and pass it on to their heirs, caring about their own family and their own children. The interesting thing is that people recognize this. The estate tax, we call it the death tax, is very unpopular. And it used to be that people on the left would say, yeah, but that's because everyone thinks that they're going to pay it, when in reality only more wealthy individuals pay it. But we found that the opposition to the death tax only drops from about 85% to about 75%. If you tell people, what if you could personally be assured that you yourself will not have to pay it?
Of course.
Which is really encouraging. People perceive an immorality to the death tax, I think, which is encouraging. It also is it's also a giant waste of money, because it takes the majority of the income collected through the estate tax in order to pay for its enforcement. So it's an incredibly inefficient tax. And once we get over this $10 million, this threshold is not picked on accident, we're going to be really close to the break-even point on the estate tax. It's not really going to bring in any money anymore over $10 million.
And what's the percentage that's taken when it's over $10
million? I don't – there was a
– Is that graduated as well?
That number.
Is that graduated?
Not really. It's graduated, but it kicks in pretty immediately.
Okay. Well, now, you wanted to mention something in this tax bill that has to do with college savings account. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. Actually, there are a couple of things in this bill that are really exciting from a social point of view, from talking about the way society is organized, particularly as a Catholic. One of these is the what we've done with 529 plans in the bill. 529 plans, people might be aware of, are a savings vehicle that allow people to save for their children's college education tax-free. So you have to pay tax when you earn the money, but once you move it into a 529 savings account, it grows tax-free, and then it's tax-free when you withdraw the money to pay for qualified college expenses. The exciting thing in both the House and the Senate bill is that 529 plans have been expanded to allow for K through 12 education as well, which really gives people an incentive in order to send their children to Catholic schools or to other private schools. And in fact, in the Senate bill, 529 funds can even be used to pay for homeschooling expenses. The House bill originally allowed people to begin saving for allowed the people to begin putting money into their 529 plans when their children were still in utero, which is really exciting. Unfortunately, that failed a procedural test called Byrd Rule, and it's kind of a long story, but we weren't able to include that in the final bill.
Now, will this survive the committee, this expansion to K through 12?
I think it will. Because a lot of people are really excited about it. A lot of organizations in town that are focused on family issues are really excited about this. We are. Everybody in the taxpayer movement is. I think it has a really good chance of succeeding. This is one of the things that we're really focused on, trying to promote and make sure it winds up in the end. There's another piece that's really exciting about this, too, is that not only are 529, do they grow 529 plans, so they grow exempt on the federal side. There are 37 states plus the District of Columbia that actually remove your contributions to 529 plans from your taxable income at the state level, which means that if you send your children to a Catholic school in K through 12, and you put your money and you put some portion of your resources into your 529 plan in order to pay for that, that money will not even be taxed at the state level when you earn it. So that is at least some measure of justice for Catholic families who are struggling to pay high tuition costs in order to give their children a Catholic education. At least they're going to be able to exempt that money from state taxes that they have to pay that they have to pay in order to get their kids a Catholic education. And that, to me, is a matter of justice. And I'm glad to see that we're making progress on this. I really think this has the potential to be transformative, because people at the margins that are like, gosh, I don't know if I can afford it, you know, we're really on the bubble, it can help, especially in those high-tax states.
Well, it seems to me that this is one of the biggest pieces of news in the whole tax bill from a Catholic point of view.
I think so, and it's really – I don't think enough people are talking about it.
Let me pose this. Let's say you put aside $10,000 a year for your child to go to a private Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that $10,000 is not taxed by the federal government at all?
It's taxed when you earn it. But let's say you just had a child, and for 6 years it grows – It grows.
Oh, the earnings are not taxed.
Yeah, the earnings are not taxed. But that money is not in 37 states and the District of Columbia. That money is not taxed at the state level at all.
37 states.
Yeah, 37 states. Those states all exempt at the they all exempt that from your income basis at the state level.
Now, how does this compare with a health savings program?
Well, the health savings accounts are the most tax advantaged account in existence. They're the only tax they're the only savings account where you do not pay tax on the way in. That is, when you earn it, and you do not pay tax on the, what grows, and you do not pay tax when you spend it. And it's the only account like that.
Is there a limit to what you can put in a year?
Yes, both on 529s and the both on 529s and on the health savings account.
What is the limit?
On the on the health savings account, I believe it's 60. It's about 6,500 for a couple a year. And a health savings account. It also requires you to have a. It also requires you to have a qualifying high deductible health insurance plan.
Right.
And I don't think there's a change to the 529. To the 529 plan limits. There are they're state by state, but I think it's usually about $5,000 per year on 529 plans, so your contribution limits.
So what would be, let's say this bill goes to committee, it gets passed, how will it play out politically in terms of the upcoming congressional election?
Well, I think Republicans consider it extremely important to pass this for the in order to have a record of achievement going into the 2018 election. And the reason is that because people are anticipating that the 2018 election is going to be a base election, that is going to be driven by the bases of both parties.
The Republicans absolutely need to pass this.
Yeah, it's a must pass thing for Republicans. The other reason they have to pass it is because there's been so much misinformation about the bill. And when people pass it, they're going to, you know, if it passes next year, everyone's going to see a raise on their paycheck. And it's going to make it dramatically more popular. If they wither and somehow fold and don't pass this, then it's going to be subject to all the demagoguery from the left between now and, you know, they're not going to be able to disprove the arguments that the left has made.
Now, if it's passed, this does not affect the next tax forms we have to fill out, correct?
Well, this will go into effect in 2019.
Right. So it'll be
2018.
Now, are the tax forms themselves going to become less complicated? I noticed they took away the deduction for tax preparation.
Yeah, they are going to become a lot less complicated. Some of that will differ between the House and the Senate, but most deductions and credits have been eliminated. More importantly, the standard deduction has been increased so much that for a lot of people, they won't even have to really worry about what their deductions and credits are, because you can opt to take the standard deduction, which is so much higher, you're just not even going to have to worry about it anymore.
What about deductions in general? Are they still going to eliminate the deduction for state taxes?
So we'll see what winds up there. That's a tough negotiating point right now. The deduction, both the House and the Senate bill have curtailed to some extent the state and local tax deduction, whereby people were able to deduct the cost of their state and local taxes against their federal income tax burden. It's been pretty controversial because on the one hand, people in high tax states are in a tough spot. But on the other, it has really altered state behavior, because if you're in a state like New York or New Jersey and you're able to raise taxes on your own constituents by a certain amount, by $10,000, knowing that somewhere around 25% of that they'll not actually have to pay. So it'll actually be paid by the federal government. So in effect, it's a way for states, high tax states, to extract money from the federal government. So for that reason, it's not it's not really equitable for people that live in more states that exercise some budgetary restraint to have to pay those additional taxes for people that live in high tax states.
Chris, we've come to the end of our time, and it's flown by. You've been extremely helpful to me, and I'm sure to our listeners, in clarifying the bill, but also getting past all these negative headlines that are coming out on a daily basis. Chris Butler, Executive Director of the American for Tax Reform, thanks for being my guest again on Church and Culture.
Thanks very much for having me, Neil.
And we'll have you back soon. And to all you listening, another great guest after the break.
The Dominican Doctor of the Church, St. Thomas Aquinas, describes St. Dominic's order of preachers as men living a mixed life who contemplate the mysteries of Jesus Christ, which overflows with an abundance of preaching and teaching for the salvation of souls. This is Father Benedict Kroll from the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. Have you ever considered a vocation to be a Dominican priest or brother? Our next vocation weekend for the Eastern Province Dominicans will be February 16th to the 18th. Contact me at 800-529-1205 or log on to DominicanFriars.org.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Jeremiah wrote these words to the Jewish people who had been forced into exile. They were no longer in their own country, no longer in the Promised Land. We too may feel like those exiles, like strangers in a strange land. So what advice did Jeremiah offer? It was simple. Plant gardens, build houses, get married, and have kids. In other words, thrive. He also told them to pray for the country in which they lived, for its welfare would be their own. When we feel like exiles, we should do the same. Thrive by living in joy, pray for the welfare of our country, and trust in God's plan for our future and hope. To learn more about biblical advice for our daily lives, visit the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan on Facebook or cbsmich.org.
The Christ the King Catholic Worldview Series continues with Ave Maria's Al Cresta speaking on They Don't Know What We Have.
No, it was a matter of lived social experience. Everybody would develop a sense of time and a sense of history because of the liturgical calendar. We would develop a sense of community with all previous generations because we celebrated the Feast of the Saints, who were members of the community in the invisible world. We would develop a sense of international community because the church was Catholic. We were members of an international body that transcended our ethnicity and obligated us beyond our own individual nation, our race, or our class.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Listen to Al Cresta's They Don't Know What We Have on Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Homeschooling, as we know it, has been around in the United States for over three decades. But in some countries, the homeschool movement is just getting started. On today's Homeschool Heartbeat, learn what countries are most friendly to home education and which ones aren't.
Mike, which countries allow the most freedom to homeschool and what do their homeschool laws look like?
Mike, it's exciting to see how homeschooling is growing so fast internationally and to see many countries respect the God-given and fundamental human right for parents to choose to homeschool. We see a lot of freedom in countries like you would expect the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. To me, it's amazing to see how homeschooling is growing even in former communist countries. For example, Russia is a place where homeschooling is becoming a vibrant movement. It's amazing to think that just 25 years ago, this country was in the grip of communism, but now homeschooling is not only possible, but poised to flourish. We see it growing in Bulgaria, Romania, the Czech Republic, and Hungary.
Mike, that leads us to our next question. What countries are most hostile to homeschool freedom?
Mike, you'd expect countries with totalitarian regimes like Cuba or China oppress homeschooling as a challenge to their state schools, which they use to indoctrinate.